I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM FM and WNYC.org. Sweet and Low is the story of that faux sweetener which was the foundation of a family fortune, invented by Ben Eisenstadt, the patriarch, who was a lawyer turned short order cook turned entrepreneur. Like all stories involving families and fortunes since biblical times, there are heroes and criminals, eccentrics and straight men, miracles and disasters. Author Rich Cohen, Disinherited Grandson, tells the story here. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Welcome, Rich.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
You've described the experience of being disinherited as like missing a plane you've got to make and the next one leaves never.
Right. Well, you realize that when people die, that's it. Your chance of correction is finished.
When was your grandmother's will read?
Well, she died in 2001. Shortly after September 11th, because I remember the funeral was in Brooklyn. It was the first time I'd seen the city from outside Manhattan since September 11th.
Uh-huh.
And it was shortly after that we found out that my mother, my brother, my sister, and I had been disinherited by my grandmother, my grandma Betty, and the exact words in the will were...
I was about to ask, what did it say?
It said, to Ellen, that's my mom, and her issue being me, my brother, and sister... I leave nothing for reasons I deem sufficient. And just to be called issue was jarring. You add to the fact that it was this sort of sweet and low fortune, it's even more bothersome.
Now, was your mother surprised by this?
Yes. My mother was surprised. My mother never had a perfect relationship with her parents, but she had a relationship with her parents like a lot of people do, on again, off again. Her father had died a few years before, and they had become very close before his death. And my grandma Betty, after that death, went into sort of deep mourning and was in this house in Flatbush, Brooklyn, the same house where my grandmother grew up, being taken care of by my Aunt Gladys, who's a woman who basically was a shut-in, is a shut-in, did not leave her house from the Nixon administration until Betty's funeral. So this woman was taking care of my grandma Betty, and there was medication involved and all this kind of stuff going on in that house. It was in this period that the will was changed and my mother and her issue were disinherited.
Well, you take issue with the use of that word. Were you obviously you were surprised by that language. Were you surprised to be disinherited, that your mother was disinherited?
Well, I'm somebody, something happens to me, I don't get the significance of it for like a couple of blocks on the street or a couple of years in time. And it happened and I just wanted to be away from it. And then as I started to think about it, and then as I started to work on this book, it started to bother me a lot because I realized that it wasn't just about money, a lot of money, it was also about legacy. And there's a point in where my grandmother is being questioned by a lawyer, are you sure you want to do this? And she's asked, are you sure you want to leave your grandchildren, specifically, no legacy? And she says she's sure. And I thought a lot about what it means to be left no legacy. And, of course, that's the legacy. Mm-hmm. The legacy of no legacy is our legacy. And it's sort of like writing this story is a way for me to say I'm taking back the story, because the story of my grandpa Ben, who didn't disinherit us, is an amazing American fortune, you know. He invented Sweet and Low. He invented the sugar packet. He was a short-order cook in Brooklyn who changed the way we eat.
Right. I want to get to that because it's an amazing story. But I have to ask you, the book is terrific. And one person might ask, and I'm just going to ask it, is this book an attempt to settle scores?
No. I think that if this book had been an attempt to settle scores, it would have been a different book, and it would have been an angry book. I wanted the book to be full of real people, which is what these are. Good qualities, bad qualities, flawed, three-dimensional human. I wanted it to be a book that was funny, and a book that you'd read and you'd never look at the diner table in the exact same way again. It was an attempt, however, to claim the story.
Mm-hmm.
And to sort of say, you can disinherit me from the fortune and you can kick me out of the club, but you can't prevent me from telling the story. Mm-hmm. And this is me telling the story.
Well, tell the story about Grandpa Ben, because, you know, he is, you know, the classic American dream. Here's this guy who took something that people took for granted every day and repackaged it, if you will, and made a fortune. Tell the story about Grandpa Ben.
Well, he was a short order cook in a cafeteria that he owned across the street from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. He was irritated by the fact that when you went to pour your sugar, the sugar bottle got stopped up and the sugar never came out, and he had to clean those things out every day. After the Second World War ended, all his business vanished with the soldiers. So he had this idea to package tea, which was a bad idea. But he'd worked in a tea bag factory when he was a kid, and he took a lot of his money and he bought a tea bag machine, started bagging tea, and no one was interested in it. So he basically was out of money, out of ideas, sitting with my grandma Betty in Cookie's Diner in Midwood, and he's sitting there saying, "What am I going to do?" And she's sitting there trying to get the sugar to come out of the sugar bottle. And he says, "Well, why not pack sugar?" So he started packing sugar, and he ultimately did that for a number of years, but he was stupid and didn't have a patent on his idea. And about 10 years later, so he started a packing company. About 10 years after that, he had this idea of packing, of creating fake sugar to put in the sugar packets, not real sugar.
But one thing, though, when he invented the sugar packet, didn't he go to the big guys to
He went to Domino Sugar with his idea, and he said, "This is my idea to package sugar." And they had two questions, basically, the way the story is told. One, how does the machine work? And two, did you get a patent? And great idea, no patent, and they just copied it. So he started packing sugar for smaller companies and other things. He packed soy sauce, he packed duck sauce, he packed sea monkeys, which people might or might not know.
Wow.
And my mother, who worked at the factory, used to say that you could tell what they were packing as soon as you walked in the door. And by the way, it's that way to this day. When you walk into that factory, it feels like you ate a whole box of sugar-free donuts. I mean, the smell is so strong, and it's in your mouth, the saccharin in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a guy, before Sweet and Low, there were these little pills that you used to drop in a cup of iced tea. He used to crumble them up and put them on his grapefruit. He was always on a diet, and this was really typical of Brooklyn, although he didn't realize it. There was all these immigrants in Brooklyn that were trying to starve themselves to look like the American ideal, like the people in the advertisements, and they were all on diets. And he worked with my Uncle Marvin and with the chemist, and they invented Sweet and Low. They put it in all different cups. They'd get people to taste different cups. Later, when there was an issue about it maybe causing cancer, one of the people that tested these cups was my father. And he said, "I knew that guy was trying to kill me." He's giving him all these cups of But they started selling this stuff to diabetics, and it plugged into sort of the zeitgeist. I always call that particular zeitgeist fat but still hungry. You know, and all of a sudden it went from a little tiny factory to kaboom, a giant multi-million-dollar company. And you take your basic dysfunctional Brooklyn family, you add a couple $100 million. That's what you get. You get my uncle who's ultimately indicted, and my aunt who doesn't leave the house, and my uncle who owns all these cats, and my mom.
I'm Jonathan Capehart here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC AM FM and WNYC.org. I'm sitting here with Rich Cohen, the author of Sweet and Low. Rich, you've been here a couple times before for other books about the music industry. Why did it take you so long to write this one, especially since it's so personal?
Well, first of all, being disinherited was being freed to write the story. So my writing career began before that. You know, my first book was called Tough Jews. And in one of the depositions, my Aunt Gladys, depositions contesting the will, my Aunt Gladys referred to that book as Tough Juice. So it's just funny. It's sort of like my writing career and this story sort of intertwine. And basically, it always would have been a great story. You know, the story of Ben and the invention was a great story. And then in the 90s, there was a scandal at the factory where it was sort of infiltrated by gangsters and alleged mobsters. And the factory was shut down, raided by the FBI, and there was this major criminal case. And then ultimately the disinheritance. And to me, the disinheritance sort of, one, set me free to tell the story completely honestly. And two, it gave me a point of view on the story. It put me outside the story, which enabled me to see it. And I always said outside but inside, like Napoleon staring at Paris from Corsica. That's me.
I'm great line.
Completely freed up to tell the story. And that's what the disinheritance did.
Now, in one of the first chapters of the book, you talk about how your grandmother gave your mom a hard time about your book, your book, Tough Jews. She wanted to know why you didn't write about her family.
Right.
Do you think this book is exactly what she had in mind, what she would have had in mind?
No. I mean, there is one specific thing she wanted me to write about, which is she had an older brother named Abraham, and Abraham was a doctor, and in the Second World War, he was attached to a battalion fighting in the Philippines, and he was killed. And he won the Purple Heart and the Silver Star. And there is a section of the book about him, and that's mm-hmm. little part is what she would have wanted. But to me, the more interesting issue are these old immigrant families, and what did Abraham mean to Grandma Betty? And the fact that Uncle Abraham died, and that after he died, my great-grandmother, the mother of Abraham, tried to kill herself by jumping off the roof of the apartment house while my mother, my uncle, and my aunt were all living there. That, to me, is the more interesting story, because my Grandma Betty took from that this idea that sort of love is finite in some way, and ultimately it leads all the way up to Ellen and her issue, I Leave Nothing. And somehow, to me, it's even connected to saccharin, which is the bitter aftertaste, you know? So sweet at the front, so bitter going away. And that was like the life of my grandmother.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, your book is about your family. Your book is about Sweet and Low and this great invention, this fortune. But it's also the story of Brooklyn. What was it about Brooklyn that you think played a role in your family and this book?
Well, I grew up in Illinois, but my mother and my father and everybody else is from Brooklyn. And I grew up with Brooklyn as kind of a religion, that you're supposed to come from Brooklyn and you're supposed to go to Manhattan. That's my father grew up in Bensonhurst. My mother grew up in Flatbush. And my father used to say it was considered a mixed marriage because of the neighborhood difference. And it was like Brooklyn was sort of this hothouse to these immigrants. And I felt like if you look at the history of Brooklyn, you start with this pristine Dutch wilderness. And you wind up with Cumberland Packing Company being infiltrated by criminals. And it's sort of like the story in some way. It's connected to the story of the country. And also that Brooklyn was the place of all this longing and all these sort of passions banging up against each other and all these little houses with these little feuds. And this was one of those. And the fact that I mentioned before that the diet craze came out of Brooklyn was not an accident. It was had to do with people's longing and their desire to be different because they didn't like who they were. I really feel that. So Sweet and Low comes from Brooklyn. The first no-cal drink called Kirsch's No-Cal Cola was a couple of Russian Jewish immigrants who came from Brooklyn invented it. And even the bathroom scale came from Brooklyn. It was some brothers who made scales for pushcart operators to weigh their fish and whatever they were selling on, and the wives of the pushcart operators started standing on them to weigh themselves because they were trying to lose weight. So they made the first bathroom scale so they could stand on it and read their weight. It all comes out of Brooklyn, and I felt like as I was researching the story that in some way it was the story of Brooklyn. And an alternate title I had was Sweet and Low of Brooklyn Gothic. Also Sweet and Lowenstein, for other reasons, which I had discarded. But I saw it as really, a Brooklyn story in a lot of ways.
I'm sitting here talking with Rich Cohen, author of Sweet and Low. If you haven't seen the book, it's on the front. It has the Sweet and Low pink coloring, and basically it tells the story of the family on the front cover and the back cover in cartoon. And Grandma Betty is all over it. Talk a little bit about Grandma Betty. What kind of person was she? Yes, she disinherited you and disinherited you using, you know, not the nicest of language.
My mother said that her mother was the sort of woman who didn't want you to think she used the bathroom. There was something slightly closed off and embarrassed about her, something almost insecure and afraid. And like I said, her parenting style, the sense I got was sort of love is finite. And there's a reason that she raised some very dysfunctional kids, I think. And basically, she was a woman who, her parents were immigrants. She didn't learn to speak English until she was a little bit older. She spoke Yiddish at the Brooklyn Girls School, I think. And I think that embarrassed her greatly. And she had a younger brother, Abraham. And when he was born, she was sort of cast aside. And it gave her these lessons. And maybe you get those lessons when you're young that she carried through her life, which is don't draw attention to yourself. Don't stand out. Don't be too Jewish, maybe. And also that boys maybe are better than girls and that there's only so much love to go around. And I believe that my mother had a very close relationship with her own father. It actually made Betty, Grandma Betty, jealous. And this is maybe the sort of snake in the garden of the family, if you will, because that then ultimately, that was the love is finite. It was if Ben loved my father, my mother's father loved my mother too much, there wouldn't be enough love left for Betty. And the factory is so much right out of the family because it was a family diner. They didn't move into some big factory. The Cumberland packing plant where the stuff is still made is the old cafeteria where Betty worked, where the grandmother worked. They just converted it. And the room that was the cafeteria has actually been left as a ruin. And they moved into other parts of the building. So it's like this room where this diner was is like almost a symbol of that old family. It's still there. It's just decayed and aged and kind of rotten. And as a kid growing up in Illinois, I saw that there was a tragedy in it, but there was also something great about it, and there was something very comic about the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. How did your family's moving to Illinois away from New York City change the relationship with Grandma Betty and Grandpa Ben and the rest of the family that was behind?
We became like a spin-off show. You know, like Joni Loves Chachi or Laverne and Shirley.
Or Golden Palace with Golden Girls, yeah.
I mean, I think it caused me to grow up kind of in a normal childhood. You know, my brother and sister used to go to Brooklyn every Friday night to have dinner with them. And there's a story in the book where there was a party given to one of the grandchildren, and the names were written on slips of paper, and a winner was drawn to see who would get the party. And the winner was my cousin Jeffrey. And my brother grew suspicious that Jeffrey won this contest. Marvin's oldest son often seemed to win, went and got the hat where the names were and undid the slips. And my grandma's yelling, "Don't look, don't look." And every slip says Jeffrey. And for my brother, it's like the end of childhood. Childhood is over and adult life begins and he sees what the world is. That never happened to me, mm-hmm. which probably enabled me to tell the story without anger.
Real fast, you start this book by saying that everyone in the family starts the family story in a different way. How do you think your son will tell the family story?
I don't know. I mean, my son is 2.5 years old. I have two sons, 2.5 in a year. And he is a storyteller at this young age. And I imagine that for him, it will be a great comedy of ancestors. And to some degree, it is like a biblical story because it is Jacob and Esau or something. It's fighting over the love and the blessing.
Rich Cohen, thanks so much. Rich Cohen is the author of Sweet and Low, terrific story about the invention of the Sweet and Low packet. Thanks.
Thank you.